Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. And what a really exciting episode it is. But before we get to it, people did say after the last episode that they were really pleased to get my own little update. They say, people who reply to me say, we love your guests and we love to hear the stories, but you don't tell us anything about you. What's going on in your life? So in my last episode, I think I was telling you that since Qantas, I'm naming you here, since Qantas cancelled my flight from Dallas to Sydney at the end of January, I was left stranded. No hotel, no luggage, and gone midnight. And I think I told you I was waiting for their reply to my claim. Well, I got a reply. They said it wasn't their fault and they're not paying anything. So we're moving on to the next stage of that complaint. I'll keep you posted. We're all in the transport business. Customer service is king. We should always be nice to our customers. And if we strand somebody who's paid quite a bit of money to travel on your airline, in this case from the US to Australia, as part of a bigger journey, well, frankly, I don't think you should leave people at 12:30 in the morning without a place to stay, without their luggage, and not be prepared to pay some compensation. I'll keep you posted there. What else have I been doing since we spoke last? I had a really fabulous evening in my capacity as president of the Chartered Institute of Logistics and Transport by going to the annual dinner for the Northern Ireland region. It took place at the Titanic Experience. Just amazing. If you've not been to the Titanic Experience, which is on the Quayside in Belfast, really do. It's a fabulous venue to go, and it's open every day for visitors. We had our CILT dinner there. We had our pictures taken on the replica of the famous Titanic staircase. And it was a thoroughly good evening and so great to meet so many wonderful transport people over there in Northern Ireland. I also had a really nice time, thanks for an invitation from the Great British Railways transition team, to be on a rail panel at Interchange, which took place in Manchester again a couple of weeks ago. Some amazing thoughts from people at Interchange about the future of public transport generally and, of course, rail. And we covered a lot of useful ground. If you weren't there, please try and stay in touch with it. It's all on the website. And hopefully we get the chance to do that again. I had a smashing evening in Stratford for the event for Women in Bus and Coach. So this is a special event that was promoting, indeed, absolutely highlighting the fabulous progress that's been made in promoting the careers of women in the bus and coach sector. And our general report, I think, is that there's been great progress, but it's way, way more to do. So we did hear from some inspirational women in public transport. Chief Executive of National Express, people working in engineering and driving jobs, and also from managers about their experiences, the highs and the lows of being women professionals in a male-dominated environment. And of course, the strong feeling that the proportion of diversity that we have in our transport businesses should reflect the diversity of our staff and also the makeup of our passengers. And finally, over 100 people turned up at the London Bus Preservation Trust AGM. That's the London Bus Museum at Brooklands. Come and see us. We're open 363 days a year. I'm chairman of the trustees. Fantastic. Over 100 people at a Volunteers Transport Museum AGM. So thank everybody who listens to this who was there. And if you weren't there, please come next time. If you're not a member, please join. Again, across on the website, take a look at londonbusmuseum.com. We'd love to see you. And if you're not a member and you just want to visit, as I say, we're open at Brooklands Museum. Okay, so there's a few highlights from me. Thank you for being interested. And now I'm going to come to my guest. My special guest is a household name. He is Will Whitehorn, famous for his long career at the Virgin Group, more recently at Virgin Galactic. He is something of a personality in the transport world. He was deputy chairman, Stagecoach in his time, and is currently seriously active in the advantages from technology derived from working in space. Now, I always get a bit irritated when people want to talk to me about my past because I'm more interested in my present. So I broke my own rule. And of course, I asked Will about his time, the highs and highlights from being at Virgin.
You know, one of the things that's happened to me in the past few weeks, which has taken me totally back into a period of my life I'd kind of almost with PTSD forgotten, has been the death of a very, very nice man called Martin Gregory. And he was a very famous British journalist in the late 80s and 90s, who did all sorts of things like arms to Saudi Arabia for Panorama, and he did all sorts of stuff with Newsnight. And one of the things he did was he uncovered the so-called Dirty Tricks affair between BA and Virgin.
I remember it well.
You might remember well, Leon, but very few people alive today do. And his brother, the Reverend Gregory, has phoned me up to do part of, you know, one third of his eulogy, talking about that period of his life, working on documentaries for for World in Action, as it was on ITV, which is like the Panorama of the independent TV network in those days. And he passed away, and we discovered after he passed away that he had actually sold the rights to Hollywood to turn the Dirty Tricks affair into a 10-part series,
no,
which has just been written and is being directed by a very famous director in America called David Leitch, whose last film was Bullet Train with Brad Pitt, about assassins on a train in Japan, to get us back to a transport theme. And the main actor who's going to play Sir Richard Branson is a guy called Andrew Garfield, who's a very well-known young actor at the moment. And you know, the funniest thing is, at the time when Martin Gregory, the journalist, wrote a book called Dirty Tricks,
which I have on my bookshelf right here, if you could see my
you
book.
Have.
I have
okay,
it.
Well, at the time when he wrote that, he said, one day this will make a mini series because it's such a good drama of what unfolded. He said, unless you've read this book, you wouldn't believe half the things that happened. I said, I know, it's amazing. But I said, I doubt it ever will. But anyway, it has. And then, to compound that, not long after Martin's death and before this memorial service, a lady gets in touch with me called Lottie, who has just made a series for the BBC called Putin versus the West. And she now wants to make a documentary about that episode because she thinks it represents sort of interesting things that were going on in the British transportation scene.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, Leon, forget that the world I started working in, okay, in the transport world. So I left university in 1981. And my first job after leaving university was as a helicopter crewman in the North Sea for British Airways helicopters, which was then state-owned by the British government and had those search and rescue contract and the transport contract for all the state-owned oil companies, oil rigs, like BP and Britoil, and all of these companies were state-owned. I then went from that job to be a graduate trainee with a company called Thomas Cook, which was then state-owned by the British government and just in the process of being privatised. I then, of course, ended up a couple of years later at Virgin Group, which was not a state-owned entity, but was an incredibly small entrepreneurial organisation. And I just think the world that we entered, both of us, in working, was basically one where all transportation coming out of the UK at almost all levels was state-owned.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I often quote this now because, you know, in public transport, the pendulum is swinging the other way. There is more state control, there's more public money, therefore there's more state involvement. And the pendulum is swinging away from the sort of swashbuckling fight on the streets of Glasgow back to state control and central planning. And the one I always point out is that nobody is suggesting in the same breath that British Airways should be renationalised. Nobody's saying that. And British Airways has moved from being state-owned and travelling to the Commonwealth so that people could travel to all parts of the empire to being a straightforward retailer. And it only flies to places where people want to go, and it charges what it can get away with in order to fill the planes and make a profit. So isn't it interesting that British Airways did make the jump to being a retailer in a way that public transport in the UK kept one foot in the utilities camp? And as a result of having one foot in the utilities camp, is now being dragged out of both feet as a public service. And I think that's really interesting because I often think that if public transport had properly become a retailer, then we wouldn't be seeing what we're seeing now.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I am, I suppose, reasonably transport-wise in the UK, fairly unique. And I've worked in the rail industry very closely with the development of the Virgin Pendolino train and the West Coast Mainline, which was the biggest private sector rail project that's actually ever happened in the UK since nationalisation in 1945. And I also worked in the airline industry And now I work in a completely different industry, which affects all transportation, which is the space industry, which is going to be the key denominator of actually the technology that develops in transport. AI and space are going to be the two things that denominate it. So I've worked across the gamut of these things. And I can say about rail, I think the following. It's a bit of a tragedy that it's all been renationalized, which it already has, because there is no innovation. And it seems to me to be back in a mode of managed decline. And managed decline was what I, as a young person, witnessed in British Rail. It was going through declining passenger numbers, a West Coast mainline, in the case of the one that Virgin took over, at risk. We had to make money out of it. We weren't just running a franchise contract in the classic sense. It was a long-term deal with the government. We had to invest in new trains. And we had to take passenger numbers that had fallen to 12 million on the West Coast mainline. And they ended up, by the time that was handed back, which it basically has been now, to nearly 40 million passengers, all travelling faster, in more comfort, with less overcrowding than they had done in 1996 when we took it over. That was a success. There's no doubt that Virgin West Coast mainline was a success. And the fact is that has been lost because only at the margin because of COVID, but more so because our habits have changed as a result of the rapid advance of advanced social media, working from home, which is already underway by the time COVID struck. And the franchise contracts the government had with train operators were not flexible enough. So they almost all went into losses even before COVID had happened. But the immediate instinct of, I'm afraid, you know, I'm going to be a little bit rude, transportation, civil servants and ministers on both sides of the House and MPs has been the solution to this is basically take it all back under state control.
As if somehow the laws of economics change under state control. You know, that somehow there's magic money under state control and you can give high wages, you can give people more days off and charge lower fares and magically the economics work.
Most things are better managed by many people taking decisions in a way which is geared to the signals that they get from the whole of the economy than being managed by diktat from the centre. We've known that since the magical Soviet and Chinese experiments with a controlled, entirely state economy. It just doesn't work. A mixed economy where you have, even if it's a state managed business where it takes market signals, is always going to work better. And we're seeing that right now in the railways. I think it's very, I mean, in Scotland in particular, where they really have been basically completely nationalised by the SNP, there is no improvement whatsoever. There is, again, decline. There's been a cut in the number of services. They are later and they're not working as well. But we had already, before this phase of the double or nationalisation happened, post-COVID, we'd already begun the slippery slope down where the state took back control and didn't have any profit incentive for operators to operate anymore. So I think actually the railways were going somewhere quite good for a while and they have slipped back where you've got all of the, I mean, why are we bothering to have a regulator anymore in the railways? They're all government contracts. They're regulating themselves. Indeed. All of these things I'm finding ridiculous.
And you look at the quality of the rolling stock that has been specified by the government and procured by the government, and we are talking about poor seats, poor seat layout, the interior decor of a dentist's waiting room, and all that wonderful marketing flair that came through the proper privatisation and incentive-led, revenue-growth-led rail is just rapidly draining away.
I'll let you into a secret that the general public have never known.
Please.
When HS2 was seriously getting funded and under consideration, but they hadn't fixed on the train design yet, it was quite obvious to all of us who'd worked in the battle to create Virgin Rail as a successful long-distance high-speed rail operator in the UK, operating tilting train technology, regenerative braking, highly efficient aluminium trains that were comfortable for people to travel in. It was obvious to us that the idea of HS2 was way out of date. what we needed for Britain at less than a quarter of the cost would have been a reasonably fast line to Birmingham. Yes, let's have some more capacity because freight on the southern end of the West Coast is difficult. And then operate on that and then on to the West Coast north of Birmingham to serve those cities of the north, a super Pendolino. A Pendolino capable of 140 to 160 miles an hour, which there are plenty of them now in Europe, which are tilt. And it could operate fast at the top end of that range on the relatively straight section to Birmingham. You'd have then given Manchester an hour and a half, Leeds an hour and a half to London. You'd have given all of those cities extra capacity. It would have been a completely straightforward way to do it. No one, and I tell you, when I mean entire team at Virgin, I'd left Virgin around the time when this was really being debated and had just joined the board of Stagecoach where I became deputy chair. And we talked about it from Stagecoach. We talked about it with folks at Virgin, my colleagues, Patrick McCall. We went to see ministers. We said, you cannot build what you're trying to build. It'll never happen. But this will give the country what the Pendolinos have already just done.
And by now, it would be operating.
Of course. I mean, it beggars belief to me. And you know what it was? I'm absolutely convinced there were quite a lot of people who were still in the mindset, and ministerially and in the senior civil service, who had less experience of operating a transport business, that it was a kind of grand projet. We must be the fastest railway. And they absolutely, you could tell there was that mindset going on. I mean, why would you build a fleet of trains? And this was in phase one before they discussed the phase two of it, which has never happened and has been cancelled. Why would you just build a fleet of trains that went to Birmingham very fast? That's true. Got there only a few minutes before a Pendolino would have got there, though, with very few stops when the Pendolino could stop. And then north of Birmingham had to go slower than the Pendolinos and hold them up on the main line because they had to go more slowly than the existing stock we'd already developed 10 years earlier. Yeah. The whole thing made no sense.
Indeed, indeed. And we'll suffer that now, won't we? The West Coast will be blocked by non-tilting HS2 trains.
Well, I don't think they'll ever take them north of Birmingham myself.
No. No.
Because they'll realise that it's an utterly pointless exercise. And also the big change that is going to come even in the UK in rolling stock and railways, if we had the willpower to introduce the technology which already works, is to manage the train separations with moving block signalling, but using space satellites now as well.
Indeed.
And that would make a capacity no problem on the UK rail network.
I think that's a huge thing. And I want to come on the future because, like you, as has been the case over decades, the technology that we develop in space has such a huge read across back on land that I think it's hugely exciting. But before I forget, because I've reached that age where if I don't say it when I think of it, I'll forget it again. You and I nearly touched in our previous lives because I once was involved with a marketing company that was the marketing effort behind, deep breath, Highland Express, rival transatlantic aeroplane run by Randolph Fields, Richard Branson's early partner in Virgin Atlantic, chaired by Ian McGregor, formerly chairman of the National Coal Board. It had one plane and it flew, my God, Birmingham, Glasgow, Newark, Glasgow, Stansted. Business terms, the drawback with that schedule is that by about Thursday, it was about 12 hours late because the cumulative delays of getting out of Birmingham, getting through Glasgow, in and out of Newark and back meant that by Thursday, it was 12 hours late. Not a good thing for an airline. The aircraft ended up in Virgin Atlantic fleet in the end. It was Victor Mike India Alpha in its time. So the aircraft ended up in the Virgin Atlantic fleet and it flew for a very short period of time. So you and I nearly touched because you were at Virgin Atlantic then.
I was at Virgin Group, but I worked a lot on the airline business at that time. I was always more or less seconded to the airline during that bit. And I remember Randolph. Now, this is an interesting tale because very few people realize that actually originally Virgin Atlantic was a company called British Atlantic Airways. And a young entrepreneur called Randall Fields approached Richard Branson, having failed with several other people to forge a business with them. And Richard decided he would back it. Now, what, again, very few people know, is that he did an interview with Vogue magazine in 69. And not all of the interview was published, but in the interview, he, and I got hold of the whole transcript of it for years later for his autobiography. In this interview, when he was 19 years old, he said, I'd like to start an airline one day. And one of the reasons we've called the new record company Virgin is because I explained to my cousin Simon Draper, who wanted to call it Slip Disc Records, I explained to my cousin Simon Draper, you couldn't put that on the back of an airline tail fin. So Randolph always tried to make out it was all his idea. That's not the case. The idea of Virgin being in the airline business, Richard had dreamed of. Freddie Laker was one of his big heroes. So Freddie Laker, for those who don't know, was actually one of the world's first modern airline entrepreneurs. I mean, Herb Kelleher in the United States, you know, he was a great admirer of Freddie Laker's. Freddie Laker started a private aviation business straight after the Second World War. Indeed. He was the first person. And it was the Berlin Airlift.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, there, as you know, there are two very good volumes of the Freddie Laker story now in print, which is just extraordinary. And as you rightly say, and did Richard Branson got a piece of advice from Freddie Laker, I remember. I think Freddie Laker said, sue the bastards, Richard.
Well, he did. So after the airline was formed and the joint venture with Randolph Fields fell apart, because Randolph and actually, to be honest with you, the professional management we brought in to Virgin Atlantic, just when I was starting, a guy called Roy Gardner, who'd been at British Caledonian, who you might remember that name, Leon.
I do.
You know, Roy Gardner basically said, listen, a lot of Randolph's ideas won't work, and he's not getting on with any of the staff, Richard. He really is, it's not helping, he's disruptive. So Richard bought him out of Virgin Atlantic, but he gave him free upper class tickets for life. Which was something I then had to extricate Virgin from. Randolph would use it almost, he virtually lived on the planes at one point.
Well, this is a glorious reminisce, and we're in danger of you and I just having a private reminisce here.
Lunch with Leon, in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Check out passengertransport.co.uk.
I mean, you and I have lived through the same period of time. We saw the first space travel, moon landings. We've lived through the shuttle era and all the rest of it. And for me, what's always been fascinating, in front of all the critics of the cost of space travel, is that the spin-off you get back home is just infinite. And you touched on using satellites for moving block railway signaling, but everything we know about materials, wear and tear, structural integrity, developing of new materials and so on, we can trace back, can't we, to space travel. And frankly, we wouldn't be where we are with artificial intelligence and computer technology if we hadn't.
No, we wouldn't, you're right. No. I mean, it was the space program back in 1959 that got a company in California, in Silicon Valley, called Fairchild Computers to start working on things like laptops and small-scale computing to put in a module which was going to go to the moon. And Fairchild and Hewlett-Packard and all the companies that preceded the Apples and the Microsofts were all given their leg up by NASA. And, of course, the US military and the space race for militarization at that time in space. But the most exciting thing about what NASA achieved is in the 60s, when they actually used this technology. Solar panels were developed for use in space, not for the use we now use them for. But that huge investment in developing a technology which would not have been done in the private sector, that's what NASA was brilliant at. NASA has done something that the UK government fails to do quite often in industry. And we must try and begin to take more attention of it. And every time politicians pay lip service to it, they don't. And that is, NASA has been an instrument of the US government to use its procurement of services now to develop technologies for consumer use, industrial use, military use, whatever it might be. So when NASA commissions that company that sent a probe to the moon just the other day, and puts its experiments on hold and pays them. It's doing what it does with Virgin Galactic, where it runs a science program with Virgin Galactic, or what it does with SpaceX, when it helped to get Elon going by giving him contracts for NASA satellite launches. As a result of what NASA has done as a procurement agency, which uses its firepower to get the private sector to now provide it with services, which is where it's changed a lot since the moon landing days, where it tried to do more of it itself, that has spurred an entirely new space industry, which is very, very, very end-user orientated, very market-orientated. It's providing loads of new services. The insurance industry is now relying on space very much. The maritime industry is totally relying on space for communications now. And you move forward into other areas. Climate change science utterly relies on space. And now, of course, we're beginning to industrialize in space. Thanks to the work that NASA did originally, Elon Musk has brought down the cost of space launch to it's 10% of what it was 10 years ago. And therefore, I, as an investor investing in space companies, can see business plans come about which can do amazing new things. And these companies are now doing amazing new things. They're doing amazing new things with agriculture, and they're doing amazing things with transportation logistics and making food sure food doesn't spoil in ports, making sure crops don't need as much artificial this or artificial that on them. Basically, space is now doing almost everything. When I hear somebody these days say, what are we doing in space? We've got all these problems on planet Earth.
Sure.
I want to reach for some kind of bludgeon.
Yeah.
Because fact of the matter is that even the GPS system has meant that we actually spoil 10% less food in ports than we did in 1996.
Is that
so
right?
We've got 10% more food production just because of GPS.
But that just shows why people now take it completely for granted, which is that their everyday life, where they are on their phone, Google Map, the times of their next trains, everything they do is coming off GPS. And because it's coming off GPS, we would be nowhere if we didn't have all those satellites locked on. And if you're going to fly your drone, you want GPS. You want the weather forecast, you need GPS. People just take it for granted. And I think that's just, it's remarkable.
The year that COVID started, year zero, as we probably will end up calling it in 1,000 years' time, the year before COVID started, the number of satellites had increased to about 3,500, 4,000 or so, and probably trebled over the previous 10 years. Since 2020, and we're now in 2024, the number of satellites has grown exponentially. So we are now looking at tens of thousands going into space by the end of this year. We're looking at 100,000 satellites in 6 or 7 years' time, and lots of industry up there. You talk about broadband from space, from Starlink, which is already taking over a lot of industrial broadband uses around the world, and has obviously played a factor in the Ukraine war. You've got OneWeb operated out of the UK, which is providing space-based broadband for industry around the world as well, and not so much for consumers directly. It white labels that. You'll soon have server farms in space because they are one of the biggest users of energy. I mean, transport is being overtaken by server farms as a polluter. And that, you know, you didn't think that day would come. The first people to predict that were Gartner, the research company in 2012, said server farms are going to overtake aviation as a source of carbon pollution in the atmosphere. And they have indeed done so. So they can go into space. And then I believe, within 10 years, we'll have solar power in space. And the number of companies, people just have no idea. Britain alone, there's nearly 60,000 people now working in the space industry. And our exports of space equipment are nearly matching that of cars out of the UK. And it's a dramatic, dramatic change. And the UK is quite good at space, but we are losing our edge because of basically the government not waking up and smelling the coffee of what countries are doing around the world in this area.
Sure.
And not doing it to encourage this industry. And I'm chair of a company called Seraphim Space Investment Trust. We have invested ourselves alone in 28 new space companies over the past few years, many of whom are now becoming, you know, major players in the industry of supplying information and data from space that is essential for everything around us to work, from the production of food to ensuring shipping, you name it, you're going to find space in the middle of it. And AI alongside, that's where the revolution's really going to take off.
Indeed. And in our own world of supply chain logistics. I mean, this is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, Britain is already at the cutting edge, frankly, of digital signalling and so on in the rail industry. As you pointed out, there's more of that to come. But across the whole logistics process of the efficient moving of materials, consolidations, the reduced number of miles, more efficiency in the use of it, optimization generally is going to be extraordinary in this industry, isn't it? And I don't think people realize that all this investment in space travel is delivering hugely to the economy at both ends of it, in terms of revenue, in terms of taxes and all the rest of it, but also in the optimization of the way in which we operate both passenger and freight.
True. I mean, you know, even personally, you know, I have an electric Ford Mustang Mach-E extended range. It's an electric car. I can now get in that car, and once I reach the dual carriageway at Horsham, the A264, onto the M23, onto the M25, onto the M40 or the M1 to, say, go to Northampton. Once I leave the back roads here and get on that dual carriageway, I don't have to touch the steering wheel anymore. Now, that's just old 64-year-old man in car using technology which is interfacing at so many levels with so many things to make that happen. And, you know, the logistics for transportation and freight movement and people movement are about to be revolutionized again, but not by the technology you physically have to move the wheels or whatever it might be you're moving, or the jet engine. It's going to be denominated from managing it from up there in space and using incredible AI algorithms to be able to tell people on the ground anything they want to know.
Sure.
They'll be able to know. I mean, like you can already in America, for example, in the bus industry, you can now, you know, sitting in the head office of whoever, whichever operator it might be, of Greyhound, for example, you know the tire pressures on every bus and the temperature of every engine and whether or not the oil is thick enough on every bus that you're operating in real time, live, coming from space.
Yep. JCB has the same, you know, bulldozers and diggers in the middle of the Congo. They know the energy consumption, they know the condition of the engine and so on. I mean, it is absolutely remarkable. Just to wrap up on this, I think transportation is such an exciting thing for young people to come into, because it isn't about tapping wheel nuts with a hammer, all that sort of stuff. These are high quality, high tech jobs that are great for young people. And for young people into transport now, it is a high-tech job, isn't it? With really rewarding, really exciting things to do. The sorts of job you do, easily comparable with gaming or influencing or all that other stuff that young people also talk about. I just think transport is such an exciting place for young people to go to.
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, I have seen gamers, for example, come out of the gaming business. If they might be working it professional, they might be gamers who are doing it as a hobby online, yeah, and join the RAF and now be managing drones.
Yes.
You've seen lots of examples that exactly attest to where to what you've just said. The problem is this. There are a number of jobs where we still need to have people. So even although trains could be driverless, as they are on many of the London Underground lines, in the case of trains on the main line, we haven't got there yet. We still need drivers in the cab, but they're not doing what they used to do. However, we can't recruit drivers at the moment in the rail industry. That's a very interesting example. One of the things I remember when Stagecoach, and I was deputy chair, and we were looking at the Health and Safety Committee and, you know, in the various committees of the business about the driver recruitment issue. And Stagecoach did better than most at recruiting drivers, as did Virgin. The biggest problem that we came across was the fact that very few people would get to the stage of becoming a driver. Of the 100 people applying for every driver's job, and there weren't enough of them applying in the first place, you still had to lose 95% of the people. And sometimes it was for things which, you know, are part of the modern world. I mean, you know, more young people now experiment with drugs than I think than did. We thought in our generation a lot of people did, but more do it now in different ways. But the problem is, it's all traceable these days.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you can now tell basically if somebody had alcohol when they were a baby when you take a
Well, indeed, indeed.
and that's a difficult issue because you know, so you're going to have to these kind of jobs where people they don't want to sit in trucks, they don't want to sit in the front of trains anyway. Those that do are often excluded for a whole set of reasons to do with the requirements now that we have. They are much more complex, and therefore these jobs are going to be automated.
But better quality, more rewarding jobs will be created in the process.
Absolutely. All my life, I have witnessed people saying the computers are taking over, all the jobs are going to go. They're saying that with AI now. They said it with the internet 20 years ago. They said it with IBM's PC in 1977. It's never happened.
There we go. Well, that is fascinating. Thank you. I just loved that conversation. It's brilliant. Thank you very much. So my guest has been Will Whitehorn, famous the world over for his work with the Virgin Group, more recently at Virgin Galactic, and also in his work in rail as deputy chair of Stagecoach, and even now, a bit like me, causing trouble around the place as we try and encourage young people into this industry and to move this country forward for it to be the leader that it often is and certainly deserves to be. So, Will, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.